The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send those comments to td@kpcg.fm. We're coming to you live again from our Edmond studio here on the headquarters campus in central Oklahoma. Thanks to Brent Noctegal for filling in yesterday. He had a little trouble getting the file sent over right at the last minute. We don't yet have the facilities to have a live broadcast from Jerusalem, but the very next best thing is for him to send that file at the very last minute, so you're right up to date with what's happening in that part of the world. In any event, if you'd like to listen into his program from yesterday, the podcast is available at thetrumpet.com and at kpcg.fm. Tomorrow, Richard Palmer will be filling in live from our Edstone studio, so you can catch up with him again as he fills in for me on tomorrow's broadcast. Well, we have a lot of news items to get to on today's program. Coming up in the second segment, we're going to be looking again at the militarization of Germany. And for some of you I know that listen regularly, it's beginning to sound like a broken record, but we have to watch, as Jesus instructed us to do, to watch and pray always. And when you see these headlines that Herbert Armstrong was talking about 50, 60, 70, 70, 80 years ago, well, it's exciting. And it doesn't get old. It doesn't get old listening to some of these clips that will line up for you in the second segment as well. Clips that our regular listeners have probably heard multiple times. You look at what's happening in Europe and then put it together with what's happening here in the United States. Richard Cohen had a piece in the Washington Post, I think this was just yesterday or the day before, where he talked about the day that will live in infamy, as President Roosevelt said back in 1941 after we were attacked at Pearl Harbor. And Cohen talks about December 20th of 2016, another infamous day for the United States, and how that was the day that Turkey and Iran and Russia, they met in Moscow, the leaders of these nations, to figure out a solution for all of the problems in the Middle East. Turkey, Iran, Russia. And as you probably saw in the headlines from about a week ago, the United States wasn't even there. They weren't even asked to participate in the meeting. Pretty amazing. Cohen says Winston Churchill said in 1942 that he had not become Great Britain's first minister in order to preside over the liquidation of the British Empire. And yet, that's exactly what happened. Because by the end of the 1940s, much of that empire was gone. Churchill tried to prevent that from happening. He was proud of the empire. He was proud of colonialism. He saw all the good that it brought to so many nations on this earth. But just as God had prophesied, you can read all about this in the United States and Britain in Prophecy. Britain, sure enough, lost the empire. And Cohen says in his piece that President Obama has been quite happy to preside over the loss of America's influence abroad, America's power and standing in the world today. He says here, Aleppo, Syria, now a pile of rubble, is where countless died, as did American influence. All these civilians dying in Aleppo, and it's also, I mean, it just shows, too, how much America's influence is gone, certainly from that region. He says the Russians polished it off from the air, doing for the Syrian regime what the United States could not figure out how to do for the rebels. The city hemorrhaged civilian dead. And America, once the preeminent power in the region, did virtually nothing. That's right, America, not that long ago, in fact, was the preeminent power in the Middle East. And on December 20th, 2016, it wasn't even invited into a high-profile meeting on how to solve the problem, the Syrian problem, the Middle East problem. The Russians managed to do what they wanted to do, Cohen says. But why not the United States? Well, in Cohen's mind, the answer's clear. He doesn't think that President Obama cared enough. Not from him ever came a thundering demand that Russia and Iran get out and stay out behind the arguably persuasive reasons to do little in Syria was an emotional coldness. This was not President Obama's fight, Cohen writes. And he explains then later how the U.S. had a very similar response to the Chinese helping themselves to that U.S. Navy drone in the Pacific Ocean. He says the White House just reacted so coolly to that that you would think freedom of the seas didn't matter. Hardly a response. Cohen says that coolness, that no drama Obama, cost lives in Syria. Instead of rallying the United States to a worthy cause, intervening to save lives and avoid a refugee crisis that is still destabilizing Europe, he threw in the towel. The banner he flew was one of American diminishment. That's been the banner America has been flying since 2009. America diminishment. America in retreat. He says finally, this is Richard Cohen's piece at the Washington Post, since the end of World War II, American leadership has been essential to maintaining world peace. Whether we liked it or not, we were the world's policemen. There was no other cop on the beat. Now that leadership is gone, so increasingly will be the peace. Now, we've been telling you that for many, many years. What happens after America? Well, there's not going to be peace in this world. Your Bible prophesies. Jesus prophesied. This is right from Jesus' own prophesying. In the Gospels, Matthew 24, where he talked about great tribulation. You put that together with the four horsemen of the apocalypse in Revelation 6. That post-World War II stability, that peaceful transition from the British Empire over to the American superpower, those days are over. Churchill said, I'm not here to preside over the loss of the empire, and they lost the empire. And now you have a U.S. president that's quite happy to preside over the loss of America's superpower status. The American Thinker had a piece. It focused primarily on this UN resolution from Friday. We've talked a lot about that on this program. Mr. Nachtigall again did yesterday on the broadcast. This shameful response or non-action, I guess, in the United Nations. Brent's broadcast yesterday on how President Obama was behind that anti-settlement resolution. The American Thinker yesterday wrote this: President Obama's refusal to veto the UN Security Council's resolution 2234, which delegitimizes the Jewish state of Israel's presence on its own land, should have come as no surprise. And the reason this particular piece caught my attention, there's quite a few articles out there that are similar to this, but the American Thinker takes us back to that Cairo speech, June 4th, 2009. And go back to thetrumpet.com and see what we said after that Cairo speech. My father responded immediately, saying, "This is not going to bring peace to the world. It's going to make matters much worse. America's enemies are rejoicing over what President Obama said early on in his presidency." Here at the American Thinker, it says, "In the name of tolerance, Obama regularly repeated Muslim Brotherhood disinformation, praising their religion of peace whenever he could, and he put special effort in advancing the suppression of the Western Judeo-Christian norms of behavior, and in particular, American values." It says, "Since he took office in January 2009, President Obama's Middle East policies aimed to legitimize Iran, facilitating its nuclear ambitions, and turning it into a dominant power in the Middle East." He talks about the Iran nuke deal, giving them $100 billion plus a few billion dollars of cash. All of that's gone now to, or certainly a large chunk of it, it's gone toward funding terrorism and rebuilding Iran's military. And the point of this piece is that, you know, we really shouldn't be that surprised about what happened last week. I mean, look at what he was saying coming into office. America Under Attack. That's been our most popular booklet since it came out in what was it, 2012 or 13? America is under attack. Well, this article goes and gives quite a few other examples from over the years. Iran's sponsoring of terrorism in the Middle East, all across the Middle East. Seizing American sailors, arresting them, humiliating the United States. And then it mentions, I think, which is quite interesting, there's been some news recently about these 80 commercial airliners that Iran got from Boeing at a huge discount, $8 billion instead of $16 billion. This is something that the administration no doubt was behind, giving them a nice deal, a great deal. And then together with that, you probably saw the headline from the other day about, well, Donald Trump's reaction to the cost for the new Air Force One project, $4 billion. Just this astronomical figure for Air Force One. And so here on the one hand, Iran gets this sweet deal, an $8 billion savings, whereas the White House or the United States, Boeing's going to charge them top dollar. For Air Force One, you have to wonder if these two deals are related in some way. Now, Boeing has since responded that it's going to reduce the cost back, given Donald Trump's criticism. But, I mean, who is the White House lobbying for most? Is it the United States interests? The current administration, I mean. Look at this deal that Iran is getting. The American Thinker says, while Obama's animosity toward Israel's prime minister, Netanyahu, is no secret, it says, it is not the reason Obama withheld his veto, allowing the shameful resolution to pass, nor was it his undeniable support for the Palestinians. It was apparently a remaining item on his to-do list in his dealings with Iran. I mean, this is just something he needed to check off the to-do list, part of his agenda. And he's obviously not going to do it right before an election, as another article I have here brings out. That would have been devastating. I mean, it was bad enough, even without this going forward. But here he is now in this lame duck period. And as I've been saying, I mean, this is a critical time to really keep our eyes on this outgoing administration. As the American Thinker says, he's not done yet. He's still got a few more weeks. Don't let the fact that he's on vacation at this time of year make you think that he's just going to kind of ride off into the sunset. As Brett Stevens wrote at the Wall Street Journal, this is a fitting finish. Sticking it to Israel right as he is about to leave office. And it shouldn't come as a surprise. Stevens, Brett Stevens, he wrote this: Barack Obama's decision to abstain from and therefore allow last week's vote to censure Israel at the UN Security Council is a fitting capstone for what's left of his foreign policy. Strategic half-measures, underhanded tactics, and moralizing gestures have been the president's style from the beginning. Israelis aren't the only people to feel betrayed by the results. And then he just lists them all off. Look at the Iranians, those that rose up in 2009, the Green Revolution, it was called. Left high and dry by this administration. What about the Iraqis? All the reassurances, all the gains during the military surge before President Obama came into office. And then as soon as the U.S. troops left, well, the U.S. wasn't so much concerned with Iraq anymore. And now they're only concerned about it because of the spread of ISIS. What about the Syrians, as Stevens writes here, whose initially peaceful uprising against anti-American dictator Bashar Assad, Mr. Obama refused to embrace? He talks about the red line and so on. He refers to the Ukrainians, who gave up their nuclear weapons in 1994 only because the United States assured them that their existing borders would be guaranteed. So much for that agreement. That was just a little over 20 years ago under the Clinton administration. You give up your nukes, look, we're going to guarantee your borders. Tell that to those living in Crimea, eastern Ukraine. Stephen says pro-American Arab leaders who expected better than to be given ultimatums from Washington to step down and who didn't anticipate the administration's tilt toward the Muslim Brotherhood as a legitimate political opposition and toward Tehran as a responsible negotiating partner. I mean, this is just left Arab leaders shocked, and pro-American Arab leaders at that, just absolutely beside themselves. And Stevens writes here, most betrayed are Americans themselves. He says, Mr. Obama promised a responsible end to the war in Iraq. We're again fighting in Iraq. He promised victory in Afghanistan. The Taliban are winning. He promised a reset with Russia. We're enemies again. He promised the containment of Iran. We're witnessing its ascendancy in Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, and Yemen. He promised a world free of nuclear weapons. We're stumbling into another age of nuclear proliferation. He promised Al-Qaeda on a path to defeat. Jihad has never been so rampant and deadly. These are the results. They would be easier to forgive if they hadn't so often been reached by disingenuous and dishonorable means. And then he goes into all the areas where this administration has worked to deceive the American people. And then says, now what about this UN vote? Last week, after all of these areas of deception, and now the administration comes forward and says, look, you know, we weren't behind this vote. We weren't actively promoting it behind the scenes. Well, there's a lot of people who don't believe that, and you can't fault them. Eli Lake at Bloomberg View, he wrote just the other day, Obama's decision to break precedent by declining to veto Friday's resolution looks entirely premeditated. This was all part of the plan. This was on the to-do list from the very beginning. It says, let's start, this is Eli Lake, let's start with what the Israelis themselves are saying. After the vote, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said he would be sharing information with the Donald Trump transition team that proves how the U.S. lobbied other countries behind the scenes to support the resolution. So Israel knows what happened. Israel knows that the United States, never mind what U.S. officials are saying, Israel knows that the U.S. was there lobbying other countries to support the resolution. They saw it coming. Eli Lake quotes from Michael Oren, a Knesset member, former Israeli ambassador to the U.S. We've quoted from him before. But he told Eli Lake, the reporter, on Monday that, well, we were conducting hearings weeks in advance of this resolution. We saw it coming. We're not surprised. We know about President Obama's worldview. We know about his policies. We know about his alliance with the Muslim Brotherhood. This shouldn't come as a surprise. Go back to Cairo. Go back to what he was saying in 2009. Well, Eli Lake goes on and talks about how that if this would have been put forward before the election on November 8th, well, that would have been a gift to the Republicans. Imagine the ads that would have come out then. As Eli Lake says, politically, the resolution would have been a gift to the Republicans before an election. Imagine the campaign commercial saying Obama wouldn't stop genocide in Syria, but he makes Jewish homes in Jerusalem illegal. He draws the line with this apartment complex. And here again, just like with the Brett Stevens piece, Eli Lake points out the history of deceit. He says, in April of 2015, Ben Rhodes told CNN that the Iran nuclear agreement would require Iran to submit to anytime, anywhere inspections. And that turned out to be a lie. And he goes on and talks about what U.S. Ambassador Samantha Power said after the vote last Friday there at the U.N. She said, our vote today is fully in line with the bipartisan history of how American presidents have approached both the issue and the body. And Eli Lake says that's what President Obama's supporters have been out there saying since Friday. And he says it's partly true, but it's also very deceptive, the line coming from this administration. And Eli Lake goes on to write, since the early 1990s, presidents have upheld the view that the status of Jerusalem should be negotiated between the parties and not adjudicated at the UN. This was President Obama's position in 2011 when the U.S. vetoed a similar resolution. After Israel withdrew from Gaza in 2005, President George W. Bush even promised Israel that the U.S. recognized the validity of some Jewish neighborhoods and population centers in and around Jerusalem. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas privately agreed to swapping Jewish population centers for other concessions in negotiations with Netanyahu's predecessor Ehud Olmert. So even the Palestinian president had agreed to legitimize certain Jewish neighborhoods there in East Jerusalem. But it says here Obama abandoned Bush's commitment in his first year in office. Then in 2011, he said U.S. policy would no longer consider legitimate any existing Jewish settlements outside Israel's pre-1967 borders unless ratified by peace negotiations. It says on Friday, after he was no longer running for office and after Americans voted in the 2016 presidential election, he allowed the UN to make his policy a matter of international law. I mean, this is stabbing Israel right in the back. This is the United States. This is the United States acting to isolate the little nation of Israel. This is the United States persecuting Israel, the lone democracy in the Middle East. Even as all these other tragedies are unfolding in Iraq and Afghanistan and Syria and Egypt and Libya and Yemen, Eli Lake says some might say this was a long time coming. Obama has been warning since he came into office that Israel's decision to keep building on land it captured in the Six-Day War of 1967 would lead to its international isolation. He just never bothered to tell us that he would abet that isolation as his presidency came to a close. It's the United States here taking the lead. He's the one isolating Israel. He's the one lobbying behind the scenes to encourage other nations to gang up on Israel. Well, when you look at what your Bible prophesies, I think I alluded to this on Monday's program, a prophecy over in Isaiah 9 in particular, talking about this relationship between the United States and Britain, and then how that these two, together they shall be against Judah. I mean, it's one thing for the Palestinians or for the Iranians or for the Libyans to be against Judah, but this is the United States and Britain. This is America. And what was once the British Empire, the two powers that can be credited most for establishing the Jewish state, for establishing Israel as the lone democracy in the Middle East. Brothers indeed. But that band that kept the brotherhood together, it is broken. That's what it says in Zechariah 11, verse 14. Then I cut asunder mine other staff, even bands, that I might break the brotherhood between Judah and Israel. That band between these brothers, it's breaking. It's broken. And as I said Monday, I mean, in the short term, Donald Trump might come into office and repair it somewhat. But these are the prophecies. These are the prophecies, and so we know where this ends. We know how this ends. It ends with Judah seeing its wound, going to the Assyrians, modern-day Germany, for help. America, by that point, well, the band has been broken between these brothers, and, of course, America, as my father's written before, is going to be too sick itself to provide any hope or help for Israel when it reaches its crisis point. That's where it's headed. And of course, with all of us, America, Britain, and little Judah, Hosea 5 and verse 5 says, the pride of Israel does testify to his face. Therefore shall Israel and Ephraim fall in their iniquity, and Judah shall fall with them. That's where these unraveling ties between Israel, biblical Israel, that would be the United States and Britain primarily. That's where these unraveling ties are leading. That's where this brotherly division is leading. All of these shifting world alliances, the United States of all nations, working behind the scenes to get the international community to isolate little Israel for homes that have been constructed in East Jerusalem. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Don't forget to email the program. You can send your comments to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
Is prophecy real? Is it anything more than a collection of imaginations, vagaries, and wishful thinking? The answer is no. Human beings have never dreamed up an authentic prediction of the future. The human mind simply isn't capable of it. Such a feat would require godlike power. What about Bible prophecy? Is Bible prophecy real? Is it different than the litany of other failed prophecies that have been discarded throughout human history? Unlike other books, particularly those books that claim to predict the future, the Bible has endured for thousands of years. Something about this book has transcended thousands of generations of human history. And this book, the Holy Bible, claims to predict the future. It claims its prophecies come not from the minds of human beings, but from the mind of their Creator, from the mind of God. Prove the Bible's prophecies for yourself. If you cannot honestly prove them to be true, discard the Bible and move on with your life. But if you can, what a spectacular book the Bible becomes. Request Herbert W. Armstrong's free book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy. This book will examine the core Bible prophecies and compare them to history and current events. More than 6 million people have requested this amazing and easy-to-read book. Order The United States and Britain in Prophecy by Herbert W. Armstrong and prove Bible prophecy for yourself.
Email your request to td@kpcg.fm or visit thetrumpet.com.
The Trumpet Daily.
And so, when it says a foe from the north is attacking her, not him, but her, not the him, the ancient Babylon, not the Babylon of 600 years before Christ, but the Babylon of our day now that is rising up, this thing that is soon to come, this thing that is going to dumbfound the people of the world, I want to tell you, my friends, the politicians of the great nations that are actually helping to build this thing and don't realize that they're only building a Frankenstein that is going to turn on us.
That's Herbert Armstrong from one of his old radio programs. We've played that clip for you before. When you put this together, this development in Europe, when you put it together with what I talked about in the first segment, this precipitous decline of the United States, Great Britain, and even Judah. And again, the headlines with President-elect Trump coming into office, I'm sure there's going to be quite a few, particularly on the conservative wing, that talk about a resurgence of American power and a strengthening of that alliance. But we're here to tell you what the Bible prophesies. And of course, all of this ultimately is good news, given where it's leading. Leading up to the return of Jesus Christ to this earth. For unto us a child is born, it says in Isaiah 9. And the government, God's government, is going to be placed upon his shoulders. And he's going to rule the earth and bring peace to this earth. But there's going to be a lot of trouble. Dangerous times in the last days before the return of Christ, Paul said in 2 Timothy 3. So we see what's happening in the United States, in Great Britain, in the Middle East. We see nations, Gentile nations, gathering together in Moscow or wherever to solve, quote unquote, to solve the problems of the Middle East or wherever. And the United States is absent. The United States is working behind the scenes to undermine Israel's position internationally, to isolate Israel internationally. To fund terrorist-sponsoring nations. To help rebuild Iran's military. To give Vladimir Putin free rein in Eastern Europe. The London Times. It says here in today's edition. Europe wants German boots on the ground. Well, that's an alarming headline. It should be. But the thing is, Europe wants this. More than that, the United States wants this. The world wants this. Maybe not Vladimir Putin. But for the most part, the Western world wants this. It says, as the U.S. warns NATO allies to increase their defense spending, the Bundeswehr has an important new role to play. I mean, here's a new role for Germany. Here's a new opportunity for Germany to step up and to take the lead, this time militarily. It says when the former defense minister of Lithuania, Well, she said she wanted to see a NATO deterrent force in her country, which borders Russia and also Russia's Baltic enclave of Kaliningrad. The article says here, since Germany lies close to Lithuania on the Baltic Sea, it would make sense, she thought, for the Bundeswehr, the Unified Armed Forces of Germany, to be part of the force. Her wish was premature. Until very recently, Germany was reluctant to send its military anywhere or even to equip it properly. Just until very recently, this is a recent development amid all these other things happening in the world, in a world that in so many regions is burning. It's on fire with division and strife, violence, warfare, bloodshed. And now amid all of this, well, Germany is changing. Germany has an opportunity now to flex its military muscle. Well, this piece goes on and talks about how that since the two Germanys united in 1990, that its funding of the military, it's kind of languished at under 2% of its GDP. And, of course, that was a point that Donald Trump criticized during the campaign season. Look, you nations in Europe have to pay your dues. You've got to pick up the slack. You've got to do your part. Well, now Germany's answering that. And to think, until just very recently, this would have been something that just would not happen. The London Times, this is Elizabeth Bross, it says the sometimes pitiful state of the Bundeswehr became known to a worldwide, well, it just talks about how in years past, they didn't have the support. They didn't have the funding. But it says here, but this year, the German government announced plans to increase its meager defense spending by 60% in the next 5 years. Ursula von der Leyen, the defense minister, has also vowed to grow the 177,000 troop armed forces by 10,000 soldiers. And from the spring, the Bundeswehr, which until 1990 was banned from serving abroad in anything other than humanitarian roles, will lead a high-profile NATO force in Lithuania. Of the 1,000 troops involved, 450 will be German. I mean, this is a high-profile international operation. This is Germany taking the lead at NATO, just as Donald Trump wants them to. It says the Lithuanian mission is part of NATO's response to Russian aggression in the Baltic Sea. The Baltic Sea region, Estonia, Latvia, and Poland, will each receive similarly sized NATO forces, with Britain taking the lead role in Estonia. And then this former Lithuanian defense minister, it says, has been proven right. It says, today German boots on the ground are neither scary nor ridiculous, but a feasible option. That's quite a statement, because it highlights just how the mood in the world has changed. Everywhere in the world, in the Western world particularly. The thought of German boots on the ground, it no longer scares people. It's no longer alarming. Never mind the history. Never mind what happened in 1870 or 1914. Or 1939. It says here, in fact, more German boots on the ground are needed. That's the London Times. That's this reputable British newspaper. Well, we need this. This is no longer a scary proposition. This is nothing to be nervous about. This is just Germany stepping forward to fill the void. It's getting the funding now. Huge increase. It says later, every country in Europe would welcome a stronger role for the Bundeswehr, says Roland Freudenstein, a German who is deputy director at the Martin Center, a Brussels think tank. He says every country in Europe welcomes this. And he goes on to say, only some Polish nationalists would oppose having German soldiers on their territory. Now, there's some in Poland that don't want this. They remember. They remember what happened in the 1930s and 40s. But look, everybody's getting on board with this, says this think tank director. He says only some Polish nationalists would oppose having German soldiers on their territory. The problem is that we Germans have spent decades hiding behind our history to avoid taking on a military role that would be appropriate for our financial and demographic size. We've been hiding behind this history. And, we've got to take on a military role that's appropriate for our financial and demographic size. And after all, we're the world's fourth largest economy. And so we should have a big military power, he says. And a lot of nations in Europe happen to agree with him. It's astounding, really, where this is leading. Well, it talks about this NATO operation in Lithuania. Germany taking the lead there. One of the highest profile operations yet. It mentions the operation in the Aegean Sea, where you have a German admiral heading up that mission for NATO. In the Mediterranean, you have 300 Bundeswehr sailors working, to stop the anti-people smuggling, or to stop those being smuggled across into Europe. In Afghanistan, there's 1,000 German soldiers there. The article says, all total, there's 3,264 soldiers deployed on foreign missions. And it mentions, Germany leading the force in Norway and the Netherlands last year. I mean, you could say, well, these are all small operations. But look, they're popping up all over the place. And my father's brought this out before with respect to the prophecy about the whirlwind in Daniel 11. How that Germany's working to surround Iran, even as the U.S. is in full-scale retreat. Even as the U.S. is not even invited to the negotiating table over what to do with Syria. You watch as Germany gets more involved. That's where all of this is headed. You see where they are in the Aegean Sea. You see what they're doing in Lithuania now, in the Mediterranean, in Afghanistan. They're becoming more assertive. They're making their presence known. And here's this think tank director saying, look, we've hidden behind our history for long enough. We've got the fourth largest economy in the world. We're the strongest nation in Europe. We're playing the dominant role in Europe. Politically, economically, why shouldn't it be militarily? And so the push to remilitarize Germany, it's coming on strong. The fact that it says here, the fact that other countries are willing to serve under Bundeswehr command and be defended by its soldiers, and that the Bundestag is willing to let its soldiers serve abroad, shows how much has changed. It shows how much has changed. And look at how fast it's changed. Just a few decades. And for the most part, people go to sleep. People are blind to what's happening. People don't care about, oh, Germany, don't talk to me about Germany. Let's talk about popular culture. There was a headline today, I forget where I saw it, that just talked about Americans and the problem with obesity, and it's just the addiction to food and fun. Blind to what's happening all over the world, even as all of these remarkable changes, these prophetic events are unfolding. It shows how much has changed, this article says. In Germany, public opinion has shifted too. So the opinions are changing in Germany. We don't have to hide behind our history anymore. We're the powerhouse of Europe. And this is a dangerous world. And we need a military. It says last December, 58% of Germans supported the government's plan to send Bundeswehr soldiers to Syria, compared with 31% who supported international Bundeswehr missions in December 2014. In 1 year's time, support for these international missions abroad, it went from 31% to 58%. And this comes at a time when, for the most part, the American support for operations abroad, military operations abroad, it's in sharp decline. Americans, I mean, in defense of Obama's policies, there's quite a few Americans that agree. We don't want to mess with Syria. We don't want to get into Iraq again. We don't want to go there. We don't want to go here. We want to mind our own business. And meanwhile, public opinion in Germany, it's shifting dramatically so. It says German soldiers are clearly needed abroad. This is how the Times article of London concludes. They've got international support, and foreign missions are becoming a tolerable thought back home. The only thing the Bundeswehr needs now is new boots, or rather, new equipment. The spirit behind it, it's there. The populist support, it's growing. And now they just need some more funding. Now they just need more equipment. Now they just need the arsenal. Now they just need more weapons. I mean, what we're looking at is the heart of Europe. That's what Mr. Armstrong brought out in that clip that we've played before. This is from his old radio program, clip one.
And some of us, my friends, know not only what we see when we're over there, but we know also what is prophesied. And we know what is prophesied to rise up in Europe. And we know which is the one and the only nation in Europe that is capable of dominating, and which is the economic and the industrial heart of all Europe, without which there could be no stability and strength. A human body cannot live without its heart. And the economic and the military body that is to rise up and to restore the Roman Empire, the thing that we least suspect here in the United States, it cannot rise up without its heart. And its heart is in Germany.
Its heart is in Germany. That's what he said way, way back in the 1940s and 50s. In 1945, you can find this quote in his autobiography. He's talking about that inaugural session of the United Nations. And Mr. Armstrong then saying to his radio audience that the war is over in Europe, or is it? He says we need to wake up and realize that right now is the most dangerous moment in United States national history. Instead of assuming we now have peace. See, we assume that, well, there's peace now. And we've got the United Nations. I mean, this is Herbert Armstrong warning the world in the days following the end of World War II. He went on to say, we don't understand German thoroughness from the very start of World War II. They've considered the possibility of losing this second round, and they did as they did the first, and they have carefully, methodically planned in such eventuality the third round. He was giving that warning, and well, it was so easy for so many people to just laugh and scoff. Although, when you look at the history of that work that God did through Mr. Armstrong, I mean, you'd have to say there were quite a few people who didn't scoff. 8 million people subscribing to the plain truth there in the mid-1980s. The many millions of viewers or listeners, those who saw the World Tomorrow television program or listened into the World Tomorrow radio program, hundreds of thousands of co-workers and donors and members supporting that work. And where are all of them today? So many of them have gone to sleep. It's the spirit of the age. So many of them have closed their eyes. So many of them are just drunk on riches. On the things of this world, materialism. He said in that broadcast from 1945 that, look, this Nazi movement, it's not gone. It just went underground. Now look at the headlines today. Compare them with what he was saying back in 1945, or this one from 1952. He says the United States is determined now to let nothing stand in the way of building up a rearmed, independent Germany. This will be the heart and core of the united Europe. And that will revive the Roman Empire. That's what he said in 1952. I mean, coming out of that war, my father's quoted from this so many times. That agreement, or that joint statement between Churchill and Roosevelt, where they said it's our inflexible purpose to destroy German militarism and Nazism and to ensure Germany will never again be able to disturb the peace of the world. Nobody's saying that today. In fact, you've got these think tank directors that are out there at the forefront in Brussels, in Berlin, in the United States, saying that, well, Germany needs to quit hiding behind its history. It needs to be more assertive. It needs more military power. And the nations in Europe are fine with this. And so is Britain. So is the United States. It shows just how much has changed. When you go back and look at what Churchill and Roosevelt were saying following Germany's defeat there at the end of World War II. And today, just like the Times brings out, it's no longer scary or even ridiculous to think about German boots on the ground all over the world. All over the world. Syria, Afghanistan, Lithuania, they're in the Aegean Sea or the Mediterranean. This is necessary. This is needful to bring some stability to these troubled regions. In fact, it's a Frankenstein monster, as Mr. Armstrong said. I mean, today, everyone's looking to Germany to lead. In spite of all of that history. Now, it's not like thetrumpet.com or this program or any of us are against the German people. In fact, God prophesies that he's going to do a work through the Assyrians, through Germany. He says in the Bible that he's going to use that nation as a rod to correct his people Israel. And then after that, well, it's the best news that you could ever imagine. There's some other developments that have to happen as well. Germany is waiting for the strong man, the Daniel 8 man. Really, all of Europe is. Look, all of Europe's looking to Germany as it is right now. And as we've been saying, the EU is going to be refashioned, restructured, all those things. But that core group of nations, they're looking to Germany, and they're looking for the strong man as well. He's coming along. He's going to get in there peaceably, as it says in Daniel 11. He's going to obtain the kingdom, this empire, this Holy Roman Empire, by flatteries. He's going to be a real smooth operator. And then in Habakkuk 1, you'll have to study these prophecies on your own because I'm running out of time here. But it says there in Habakkuk 1 and verse 11 that he's going to experience a mind change. And then we're right back to 1870. We're right back to 1914. We're right back to 1939. Isaiah 10 pretty much tells the same story. Howbeit, he means not so, verse 7 says. Neither does his heart think so. But it is in his heart to destroy and cut off nations, not a few. That's where this is leading to. That's where we're headed, to great tribulation, followed by the establishment of God's government on this earth. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show, as we put the finishing touches on another live broadcast from our Edmond studios, right here on the beautiful, beautiful Herbert W. Armstrong campus in central Oklahoma. If you'd like to email the program, you can send your comments to td@kpcg.org. anchor.fm. Thank you for joining us today, and we'll see you tomorrow.